Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, packing to go on a big journey tomorrow. So it is more than perfect that I have one of my favorite humans on the planet as our guest today, Naomi Shihab Nye, whose latest book is I'll Ask You Three Times, Are You Okay? It is a book that is an ode to cab drivers, the journey, the detour, the kinship gleaned from the stories we befoibled beings exchange, especially when traveling, and always kindness. And as I was reading it, so many useful things that we'll dive into, but I was reminded also of our great ally, Martin Prechtel, who said that when he's in his prolific writing books, he said, oh, it's easy. He said, I sit down at my desk and I imagine a big bus pulling up, and the bus is labeled book, and out of it tumble all kinds of workers labeled words. But after reading Naomi's book, I think that on my desk will pull up a big taxi cab labeled book, and out of it will tumble, you know, words in the form of just, again, all of these fantastic humans as we all are. So welcome, Naomi.
Thank you, Caroline. So great to hear your voice. Thanks for your kind words.
Yeah, and it's so perfect because we are in the Virgo season right now, and Virgo is about micro, small details tell big stories. And that's so much what you're up to. And then just one other thing I want to put on our table and then we'll dive in. But right now the sun is what's exactly lined up with what's called the south node of the moon, where we push off from and what we gather for the next stage of the journey. And its image is a little girl holds a sheaf of wheat over her head as she performs a spinning dance. And I go, ooh, that's kind of like you.
And it's that's beautiful.
And it's opposite the north node, which is the direction which growth lies, which is a girl blowing a trumpet triumphantly. Resurrection, joy and exuberance for life. And I go, that's you too.
Wow. I don't know about the triumph, but I like the images.
That's really good. So what a treat this beautiful book is, and especially to read right as I'm packing, and I will go right home and take things out of the suitcase, as you advise. So, people speaking in poetry.
I love the idea of toasting your journey by our conversation, because I think, you know, whether we're going on the little journey of every day or the big journey to the other side of the world, it's always good to remember how many great stories there are out there waiting for us and things we could never anticipate. And I think that was the spirit of making this book, is that, you know, as we're on that journey, as we're on the path, on every little detour, something will be given to us if we want to hear it.
Absolutely. And that so many themes I want to put in our elixir, our brew, you know, that because every sentence I read, it was so fun, reminded me, like, oh, I've got a story like that. Oh, that's good. You know, that innocence will sometimes protect us and sometimes get us into trouble.
Yeah.
You know,
that's so true.
You talk about, yes, getting into the wrong cab, hitchhiking, you know, all car wrecks, you know, the journey. I love also your father when you say, you tell him you're going to be a poet, and he says, I am the chauffeur for foolishness.
Well, we all have those voices in our lives, too, saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't where you were supposed to be going. And I think, you know, we have to keep reminding ourselves that there are so many roads in any day. And when we're having a down place, too, you know, what little turn could we make that could change it?
And also the perfect stranger.
Yeah, many perfect strangers.
With the right word at the right time, even when we go, oh, no, somebody's sitting beside me on the plane. Oh, no, but there's an important conversation.
Yeah. And well, you know, don't you think we're being keyed up these days to feel the sense of the ominous stranger all the time? You know, I mean, that's sort of the tuning fork, the note that we're given. I'm fascinated by how many kids, when I say something to them, like in an airport or bus terminal or, you know, train station or whatever, they just happen to be next to me and they're looking at something I have with interest, or they say something and I say something back, how suddenly they're panic-stricken because they've been, you know, told, beware of those people out there, and I think, wow, you know, they're with their mom right here. She's sitting right next to me, and still they're panic-stricken. How is this person going to be ready to meet their days on their own? You
well, know, what well, kind of, yeah. Well, what
kind of ambiance are we creating among kids?
Right. You know, but I think that's where the playful trickster part of us and the curiosity comes into play, because my hair is now, I've let it go sort of silver and lilac, so I've changed tones. So kids are always saying to their parents, look at that woman's hair. Look at that, you know, and sometimes, you know, hard, grim-faced punk teenagers in line will point at their hair and then give me a thumbs up going,
that's great.
And airport security goes, God, I wish I had a job where I could do that. And I go, you could, you know.
that's good. You got to remind them, right?
Well, this theme about the journey, I mean, we love words, you know, and as you say, it's hard to be lonely in a world of words. And, of course, the word conversation, con means with and versus turning. You know,
beautiful.
Yeah, well, we're turning in the universe. It's one big turn. You know, we're conversing in the universe, and that we do. We live in a conversational universe. Everything is talking and telling us its story all the time. If we were just as acutely open as Naomi Shihab Nye. I was going to read, you know, all of your important credentials. You know, that you've, well, the poet, essayist, novelist.
I don't have any.
You know, Lanham Fellowship, Guggenheim Fellowship, you know, collection, 19 varieties of gazelle poems of the Middle East, finalist for the National Book Award. But I also think the things that are most intimate is I wander into a bookstore in Baltimore and I see a signed copy of your book and I go, I know her. And they go, she's one of our great friends. And I go to the Mac store to get tutoring in computer literacy. And the guy is a poet. And I go, I know Naomi Shihab Nye. And he falls on the floor. I mean, it just opens doors. Your name opens doors.
That's very sweet. That's so sweet.
Yeah, and I didn't know when, I mean, it's true, when we met and cavorted and were roommates, I and had such great fun, I didn't know you were such an important big deal, and that's good too.
Well, I'm not a small deal, but I have to say that, like, you have the gift, Caroline, that simple phrases that just come popping and careening and flying out of your mouth give me goosebumps. And, you know, I think, who are the lucky people who will get to meet you on this trip that you're taking tomorrow? I mean, that's the kind of thing that I can really think about for a long time that gets me, you know, just gives me a lot of imaginative fuel just to think about all the people we encounter that we, you know, pass by.
And we coach each other, too. It's like once when I missed a flight and I was like, oh, no, this is big trouble. And another friend on the phone said, well, you wonder what conversation you're going to have, you know. And again,
that's right.
Not with expectation, because that never works, you know, but with willingness. And yes, this man sat down and he was on his way first to Iran. And then as the conversation deepened, he said, actually, I'm going to the green zone. I'm Iranian, but I'm trying to help what I can. And then, you know, I said, well, send me secret reports, you know. So, yeah, everywhere.
Amazing.
And Jupiter is the god of travel and stories and journeying. And, I mean, I love skycaps like cab drivers. I want to throw it back to you, too. But as you know, storytellers, but also blessings. I always ask the skycap to, you know, would you bless my bag so it gets there? And they always do the little hand gesture like, whoa, wuzza. You know, even people behind the counter. And they like being asked to do this strange thing. And I think it... really,
wow, that's fantastic.
Works.
I love that.
Well, I want to elicit blessings along the way. And I remember seeing a skycap once and, you know, family in front of me with 8 million bags, you know, and then they left without tipping him. And he caught my eye and said, you know, I've been in this business a long time. I had the great good fortune to have a mentor who told me some people can't tip. It's an expensive city. Some people are rude. You know, if you get fried, go take a smoke break, because at the end of the day, it all evens out. And I'm like, oh, thank you, Master Grud. Yes, really wonderful. And cab drivers, ode to cab drivers. Yes, take us there, because there's so many stories.
And they're waiting. You know, cab drivers are waiting to give the lift, point A, point B. They know all the roads. They know everywhere.
They know the restaurants.
I don't know how they have such great maps inside their eyelids, but they do. And they're very excited when someone steps in who, I think, responds. Of course, we all have cab drivers who are tired, who don't want to talk to us, who are, you know, talking on their cell phones or
dangerous, as you say.
Yeah, or a little dodgy, as they say in England, but But I think more than that, we have the ones who are open. I don't think they would take that job if they weren't kind of open to humanity, you know, all the people they're going to have to meet. And so there's that sense sometimes of just, you know, what is the little precious nugget that they want to ask or want to tell at that moment? And I think sometimes, you know, if we could just get in the cab and say to whoever's driving us, you know, what are you thinking about now that helps you live your life? Or what kind of wisdom have you heard that made any sense to you lately? You know, sometimes I like to ask those kind of open survey questions just because I need to know their answers, and many times they'll get going. But so many times they get going if you don't ask them anything, if you just look slightly interested in their existence or,
well,
you know,
the cab driver from Peshawar.
Right. Oh, my God. Just the hat connected us. Just wearing the same hat. Or any little you know, slight connection where they say, you know, where they're from, and you say you know someone from there, you've been there, you just read a report from there, or something, you know, something that gives us a human bond. And I think that's something we desperately need in our world right now. So many things are trying to separate us all. So many things are trying to say, I'm better, you're worse, you're dangerous, you're this, you're that, I'm something else. And every single chance we get to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm like you, or I reverberate with you, or I identify with you, or you make sense to me, we better do it, because there's a big tide. There's a big tide pushing the other way. So, you know, I tell that to kids these days. We may think that we can't, nothing we do matters, or that we can't, you know, make a difference in terms of kind of the world tone. But I think we can. And every time you're friendly, or every time you're, you know, in response to someone else, you say, you know, what you said today helped me. That you can't weigh that. You can't.
Well, there is, you know, the bus driver, the cab driver, often the perfect word exchanged. You know, the cab drivers that you delineate, and I think we can feel this too. I also have been in many cabs where the cab driver had the secret to world peace. You know,
yeah.
And in New Orleans, got into a cab, you know, and I just bought an Arabic phrase book, because, as you know, I always feel kinder and more and wiser and more refined with anything to do with Arab culture. And my cab driver was Palestinian. And so as we drive to the airport, he goes, yeah, you know, and as long as there's oil, there'll be war, and here's what's going on, but here's what we can do, and here's the, you know, it's good. And as you say, the narrative of story, you know, that was before Katrina, is like, so I go, I wonder what happened to my cab driver.
You know? Right, and it made New Orleans ever the more personal, because you had had that encounter. Like, any one of us who had personal memories in New Orleans, or friends, or, you know, cafes where we had, you know, exchanged warm hugs with one person more than once, it made it such a person. Everything is personal. I guess that's one of the things that writers come to believe, that everything is personal, and nothing, you know, nothing should be allowed to help make us believe otherwise. But I think sometimes politicians like to believe otherwise.
Well, you have a number of stories about being saved by strangers, again, where our innocence does come through, where,
right,
you get out of the bad car and onto the bus driver's bus, and phew. And I, again, everything I read in your book, I'll Ask You Three Times, Are You Okay, is the book, and it did draw up some crucial thing once in outside Playa del Carmen. I mean, I used to be much more reckless, as I guess you did too. And
We all did.
We were all, as you open one chapter by saying, when I was in high school, and therefore invincible, you know, or immortal.
Right.
Immortal. Yeah, and anyway, so I was out there, and I'd arranged to get a ride, but it had gone, and I in ruins, and people were like, oh, you're a woman traveling alone in Mexico, and I was like, oh, no, it's okay. But then everybody was gone but me, and I had to walk miles to the main road, and as I walked, I started to hear wild dogs, like, bah, bah, and I was like, one of those things where you go, no, let me, no, and I was like, oh, no, and there was nobody around, and the dog started to run towards me, going, bah, 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 and out of the blue, over this hill from behind me, but I knew there was no car behind me, came this car packed with Mexicans. They're like, get in, and as they closed the door, the dogs are like, leaping at the window, and they're like, what are you doing out here? And I was like, oh, thank you. Again, the strangers who save us, and may we be that for others. You know, maybe we'd be the car coming out of the dark at the last moment when somebody has recklessly gotten themselves into some hole and go, oh. So, yeah, hitchhiking as young people. Jupiter the Journey is also the guardian angel. You know, we do get into these scrapes, but here we are talking alive. So
right.
Whatever recklessness we've done, somebody, something was watching out for us.
Right. And how many of us have found, you know, deep friends of our lives while on odd little journeys or little detours? Probably all of us have. And ever the more reason not to put up walls against the stranger surprise who's waiting everywhere to befriend us.
And, you know, my previous favorite book until this book about travel is a book called The Saddest Pleasure. I don't know if you know it, but it's...
I don't know that. I'm writing the title right now.
I can't remember. Well, it's from a quote by somebody important, but in which they say travel is the saddest pleasure, because this is the contrast to your book, because in far away, alone, you know, middle of the night airports, we replay our whole lives, this saddest of pleasures. But your book is, again, the happiest of pleasures. You know, it's not solitude playing out. It's what comes into that solitude at that moment. The trucker who picks you up and tells you never to hitchhike again, and you don't.
Right. That's right.
You know, your word okay when you talk about, forbidden kissing in the back of a cab in Jerusalem. And then later when you meet this person again, you tell him he's too chatty and you won't marry him because you want more silence. And he says, okay. And a friend of mine recently was like, she was taking off her wedding ring and going, oh, I feel better. And then putting it back on and going, oh no, it doesn't feel right. And she said, okay, I got to do this thing. I'm going to cook a nice supper and I can hardly eat it. I feel like throwing up. And at the end of supper, she said to her husband, I don't feel like being married anymore. And he goes, okay.
It's a very operative word, isn't it?
Well, it can be wonderful. Like, you know, something like, oh my God. Okay. Like, is there an underlying agreement all the time, if we just dove down for it, you know, like, right, you know, why carry these burdens of angst alone when the other person might be agreeing? Okay, right. Let's not be married, whoa-hoo, rather than, because if we don't say it, we'll never know, you know. And
right.
So,
right.
Yes, and then the car wrecks and the everything, but...
That's amazing. That's quite an amazing story you just told us, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, where the title of my book came from, when I was looking for, I couldn't really figure out a title. And by the way, at the time I was doing the book, I did not remember specifically that it was 50 years, that it would come out in a year that was 50 years since On the Road came out. I had, you know, although I was a big Kerouac fan growing up, I had no specific memory that this was, you know, 50 years later. But it seemed perfect right when this book is coming out right now, and I've been reading all these 50 years since On the Road came out. Oh, that's just great. I love it. That nice round number. But meeting that genteel taxi driver up in Syracuse, New York, early before dawn, who's, you know, it's dark, and he's picking me up, and where he says that weird question that, you know, when it's dark, and since he was a gentleman and I was a lady, and it was dark, that he would ask me three times between my hotel and the airport if I was okay, and all I had to do was answer, that would somehow be a consoling note in the cab. I just thought that was the weirdest thing ever, but it gave me the perfect little story to turn my introduction on.
But that might be, I mean, to another person, that might be a little spooky if somebody kept saying, are you okay? Is there a reason I shouldn't be?
Right. No, it was so strange. I mean, it would be like saying to someone else, you know, every 5 minutes, do I look all right? Or are you really feeling well? Or, you know, it was just so peculiar, the kind of repetition of it. And I wondered, you know, the history, how had he come up with the idea that if you did something three times, it would sort of make it. But it almost took on a kind of a potion quality, Caroline.
Well, fairy tale.
If I ask you three times, then we'll know for sure. It reminded me of a childhood story. You know, like you say the magic words three times, and then we will be okay, and we'll be in comfort. And as long as I would allow him to say that, I could ask him anything I wanted about the history of his city. No, it just seemed, wow, this is so great.
Right. Well, it is. It is. Again, the talisman that gets us through the underworld. You know.
Yeah.
I'm okay. Okay.
Right.
And intimate communications with strangers. The freedom. The extraordinary. I was reading your book and remembering once in Sonoma County having dinner with a friend, and at the table next to us was a couple who were engaged, and he kept saying creepy things to her that we couldn't help but overhear, like, gee, I like you better when you're liquored up, you know? So on the way out, I turn, and his back is to me, and I'm facing her, and I go, and I just mouth, you cannot, you will not marry this man.
Oh, my God.
And she looked puzzled, and he looked, and then I go away, and I go, okay, I just had to do that. You know, again, there was these intricate, tapestries. And, I loved how, I can't remember where you were, but in which, I think Jordan, in which you said that, you know, when we raise our hand for a cab, you said, you can say anything, taxi, but you can also say hope, pain.
Yeah. Cauliflower,
rutabaga, but in your book you go hope, pain, and the cab pulls up, and I also loved your friend. I think you'd escaped from a bad cab ride in New York, in which he said, "Oh man, I could tell it. I could tell it was going to get worse."
Yeah, that was Coleman Barks, the translator, the poet.
I know him.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
it's only time we've ever taken a cab together. And it turned out to be a really crazy, scene. And he just said, we've got to get out right now. Open the door. And so we each got out on our different sides, and he threw some money at the guy, and we were out of there standing in the middle of a busy street. And he said, we just had to. It was going to get worse. I could feel it.
Right. Oh, man, I could tell it was going to get worse. That's really useful. And then...
maybe we should think about that these days, politically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man, I could tell it was going to get worse. Well, the journey and the travel and the opportunity to converse with strangers, I think now is so opportune. I always bring up the world, and I think people are so, there's such a point of opportunity right now for discourse if we're not grumpy or righteous or, whatever, because everyone's going, whoa, and we do say, and no, Bush cannot have $50 billion more for this war, right? I mean, that's a good conversation opener.
That is.
Yeah.
Well, and we need to keep saying it everywhere we go. I just had a piece in the newspaper here in San Antonio, Texas, where when I was traveling last year in four different countries where I was working, I would just ask all sorts of people, whether the guy who was coming in to bring water into my room in Egypt, or, the guy who was taking me to see lions in South Africa, or the concierge at a hotel, whatever. I would just ask every person, hello, excuse me, what do you think of the war in Iraq? And I would just start that way, and I wouldn't say anything that I thought, but I would just ask them, and I kept this kind of notebook of their responses. And so I wrote a piece about their responses. And one thing quite noteworthy to me was, out of the many, many responses, no one said, brilliant idea, fabulous idea, look how well it's going, what a great plan. No one anywhere. Yeah. And I think, that the conversations that we can just sort of overlap with, too, can be very important ones to keep quoting. The word overlap comes to mind because I often think, it's not that you're the speaker and I'm the listener, I'm the speaker and you're the listener, but that somehow the fabrics of our days have overlapped here. And, we're allowed sort of glimpse one another's kind of energy field for a moment, or where I'm going, what you're doing, how your day's been, how my day's been. And so in that intriguing overlap, that's where the texture gets a little nubby and fascinating. And, so I don't get into a taxi feeling like, wow, I'm here for you to say your words of wisdom to me. I get in kind of thinking, well, here our lives are sneaking up on one another. What will rub off, if anything? Who knows? Or if I ask you, what do you think of the war in Iraq? I mean, you may have exactly the quote I've been looking for, as in fact so many people did, as you said, all the people who have the answers for world peace. At least two people in two different countries said things to me like, if here we are in Egypt, if we wanted to go and overthrow your leader and kill countless numbers of your civilians and take over your streets, would Americans find that appropriate? And that's what we feel about the war in Iraq.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You know, just making these little parallel stories. And in South Africa, people said, well, you know, if we didn't approve of something going on in Algeria and we decided to go fight there tomorrow, would the rest of the world go, oh, great plan. You know, now South Africa's fighting in Algeria. That really makes sense. No, probably not. I think why is this so far-fetched? You know, those of us who've been against this whole enterprise, I never have even really thought of it as a war. I've thought of it as an invasion. Those of us who've been against it from the beginning, why is it far-fetched to Americans? You know, it should be just, you know, really weird if you think of a parallel situation.
And that is always good to bring up that story. I did see one of my favorite bumper stickers recently, which said, be nice to America or we'll bring democracy to your country. I was like, who's driving that car? Let me try and keep up with them.
Oh, my God, that's a good one.
That was really good. And then it's true that I have never had a neocon cab driver who, you know, touted the war line. Because, as you say, you know, any place, you know, Washington, D.C., you get into a cab driver. My cab driver had escaped from Pol Pot in Cambodia. All of his family was dead. You know, story. It was a doctor. I always ask, where are you from? And like you do. And
right.
Your Peshawar cab driver who went into that beautiful thing because he asked you, how many rose bushes do you have?
Right. That was his opening line. How many rose bushes do you have? And I was dumbfounded. I said something kooky, like, on me? What do you mean? And he said, no, wherever you live, how many do you have? And there was sort of a sense of, you know, have you tended your beauty back home? Do you have as many as you could have? You know, have you paid attention? Do you know the answer? Have you paid attention to them? And
well, of course, he asked the question he wanted you to ask him.
That's right. He did. And we do. You know, I guess when we're wandering around the world as Americans with American passports, we want others to say, well, what do you think about the war in Iraq? So we can say, I wish it never happened. I think it's a disaster. I don't want all these people dying. You know.
Well, because when you did ask the cab driver from Peshawar, how many rose bushes do you have? He said 80 in this country. And you said, how many do you have at home in Peshawar? And he said 400. And you said, you know, such a lot of work. And then he said, not work, beauty. We go, oh,
right.
That's so wonderful. You know, I have an American passport holder, the only thing I've ever gotten on eBay for $3, and it says, it looks very official, and it holds the passport in English, French, and Arabic. It says, I did not vote for Bush. And that is a great conversation opener. People actually in American thing, when I went to get my Syrian visa, the very stone-faced, you know, consulate guy looked at it quizzically and then said, you do not completely approve of your president? I go, no. He goes, you will have a very good time in Syria. It's like, oh, okay, you know, complete deadpan. I want your blessing and the blessing also too, because when I got my new passport, I just got the new passport, and the new American passport is so grumpy and strident, and the eagle is so like, eh, and all the quotes are like, we're the best, and it's just horrible. So I couldn't, in a moment, I just couldn't resist. I've slightly decorated my eagle in the passport. I gave it purple eyeshadow and a smile. And then a friend of mine works at the State Department, goes, oh, you do tempt the gods, but that's very good. And, you know, here's my number at the State Department in case you get harassed for defacing. And I go, all right, okay. But it is that sense of going, no, my eagle is a happy eagle with lilac eyeshadow. That's the America I want to go out with. I don't want this, we are the best war grumpy thing. So we're gonna think that either, anybody who notices will not mind, and or else they won't notice at all. Yes.
Oh, I love that. Well, and my eagle loves your birds. My eagle wants to know your birds.
Yeah.
Well, since you're launching on your journey, I asked a friend of mine who is a wide traveler and also an expert in Middle East affairs.
Ah.
Although she herself is an American, I asked her, at the beginning of all this tragedy, what are some words we should keep in mind in the coming days? And she said, very simple, arrogance, ours, humiliation, theirs. Neither of those words are ways to make friends.
No.
And you know, that's really stayed with me when I travel. You know, I think we all have an arrogance detector, and none of us, I've never met anyone who appreciated being humiliated. And I think, you know, when we look at the ways countries behave,
yes, I want to come right back. I want to come right back to that. We're going to take a very short break, and our guest today is Naomi Shihab Nye, and we will be right back after a very short break. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. And our guest today, one of my favorite humans, is poet Naomi Shihab Nye, whose latest book is I'll Ask You Three Times, Are You Okay? So certainly you've been doing such great work, Naomi, also of bridging, building the bridge between the beauty of all of our befoibledness, but certainly, you know, where there's Mars, let there be Venus, as a, you know, an ambassadress of the beauty and exquisiteness of the Middle East, which is so important and to which we're so dedicated on this show. Right where you left off about Americans going, blah, blah, blah. You know, when traveling just in Syria and also in Turkey, I did delight in saying, you know, to guides and friends and cab drivers, you know, we are a very simple and ignorant people. We Americans, we have no sense of history. Please, you must forgive us. Because it's true.
Wow.
It's true. Well, it always brings a smile. And as we've spoken before in the past, what I love also is, you know, kind of kindness and irony that comes from that compression in which, you know, of people, cab drivers, you know, Bedouins, you know, people in Beirut who've seen so much and yet have kindness, you know, and that's not only the title of your, you know, one of your most known poems, you know, kindness, but it is something that you are, I think you're an ambassador of kindness.
Well, you're very generous to say that, but I think that we're always, we're always trying to encourage it in one another and re-find it again in our own context, in our own country, and be reminded of, you know, how many places it exists everywhere in our country and in all the human hearts here and in all so many places, you know, where power and money are not the things that are being focused on.
And I guess that the journey and the empathy, the small details that tell the big stories, when I read your work and your book and your poems, it always dredges up things. I remember the hit and run accident I saw when I was a child and seeing the man's groceries strewn across the street, you know, a box of cornflakes, a new toothbrush, you know, and you go, oh, their journey. Oh my goodness.
Oh my God, that's so haunting.
But your wonderful story about Dora, you know, the stranger in the car.
Yeah.
And I
think of her every time I pass Dora Street.
Well, can you just sort of set this up for our listeners that you came back to your car? And
I came back to my car. I had just gotten my driver's license. I was 20 or 21, so it was late. You know, all my friends had been driving for years already, and I'd already had like one misadventure because I was a driver, by ruining someone's violin bow that I had borrowed by leaving it on my roof. Anyway, I was not happy about being a driver, but I was pressed into it. And I come back and get to my car, and there's a woman, an elderly woman, sitting in the middle of the back seat, and she refuses to get out of my car. And I keep waving her out and telling her, no, you have the wrong car. I'm sorry, I don't know you. Please get out. And she won't get out. So I don't know what to do. This has not been covered in my driver's manual that I have now, you know, studied ferociously since it took me four attempts to get my driver's license. And so I end up driving her to my parents' home, and and asking them what I should do. You know, what do you do in the case when someone's in your car and won't get out? And so this, you know, stimulates some family discussion, and my mother ends up coming with us, and the only word this woman has uttered thus far is Dora, which I assume is her name, but, and so I keep referring to her as Dora, but it's not. It turns out it's her street. And so, as we're driving around, my mother sits in the back seat with her, and my mother says, just start driving around, and I'll keep my eye on her and see if, you know, anything perks her up back here. And, you know, there's more stuff that goes on. But anyway, we do eventually find her. She smiles as we pause at the stoplight at her very own street, just out of, you know, just as by accident. Thank God I went that way. And my mother starts screaming from the back seat, she smiled, stop the car. And so she starts motioning then to turn, and I turn and take her home. Well, you know, there's a woman I never saw again, but she profoundly marked me as a driver. You know, the idea that we may all be driving the unknown person around, the unknown friend, the person who never speaks.
And then
the last story is about really driving ghosts around in the car. The last story in the book. And a child who is quite very much believing that they're still in the back seat, these two women he loved who have recently died, that were still driving them.
His great aunties.
Yes, great, both of them. And so, you know, I think that kind of marked me as a driver, too. You know, when I started doing this book, I was always the passenger, but the more I worked on it, I realized that some of the stories, you know, they all kind of cross over and mix up. When we're the driver or the passenger, it all kind of goes together, the ways we see, the perspective.
Well, again, reciprocal blessing. It's like, you know, you got Dora home to her street, and may we, you know, when in kindness, when I swim bugs, you know, out of the water back to the sea, even though, you know, I do eat meat, you know, I mean, these irrational things, but it's like, I do feel like it could be me, and I'd be so grateful, and, you know, we could be Dora someday, but the thing I love, I mean, I love your father, in the stories so much, I am a chauffeur to foolishness, but when you take Dora back to your parents' house and she won't get out of the car, and someone says, drive her to the hospital, and then your mother says, no, that will upset her, we should never upset elderly people, and then your father says, drive her to the newspaper and have them interview her.
I love that. Well, as a newspaper man, he always had that, you know, in the back of his mind.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a story. This is an interview. You know, so I definitely grew up in a house where everything was a potential news story or, you know, feature story of some kind. And, that was all very, very non-fictional.
Yeah. Well, there is a great moment also, too, where you have a friend who's about to be not a friend, and he says, let's take off all our clothes and drive to Austin. And you're like, why? You know, what for? And then you say, he would not be my friend long. We were not on the same map.
Yeah.
Maps.
That's right.
Maps are good, you know, because when we talk about cab drivers, they did a study of London cab drivers that their brain actually is different. The hippocampus, I think it's somewhere in the front there, is huge in London cab drivers. And it's a map, it's the map navigating part of our brain, and it actually does change.
That's phenomenal. I've never heard anything like that, Carolyn. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, so the map, there's a mapping part of our brain that we're turning over to GPS and everything, you know, so as our brains atrophy. But yes, people talking about getting into cabs, like apparently in Tokyo where there's no addresses, and they say the cab driver will just go into a trance, just go, hey, and then just go. And London cab drivers, they have all that mapping and all that navigating. They might be almost as clever as crows. There's that wonderful quote, if humans had black feathers and could fly, few would be clever enough to be crows. Except maybe cab drivers, you know, and
Wow, no kidding, cab drivers, yeah.
So
yeah, and that feeling of being, I'm fascinated always by the bystander, the witness, or the person who, you know, is just sort of not the person, not your destination, but the person you're passing on the way to your destination. I mean, even as a child, that intrigued me. You know, whoever's in front of us and behind us in the grocery line, we're not just here to get to buy our groceries and get them home, but who do we have to look at here in front of us and behind us? And, you know, that's kind of how my mind worked. They became the significant ones on my map, the person I would think about, you know, as I lay in bed before I went to sleep. I'm just haunted. I'm so distracted during our phone conversation right now thinking about that man and his groceries that you saw in the street after the hit-and-run accident when you were a child. That's profoundly haunting. And I think sometimes in the images we see from war places, war zones, you catch, if you look at the back of the photograph, you catch some, you know, bit of debris, the child's toy thrown down in the rubble, the little plastic sack on the way home from the pharmacy. And those are such haunting little elements, testimonials of human life, you know, trying to carry on, trying to get through.
Well, and I think that, again, part of your wonderful devotion is that, you know, poignancy is kinship. When we go, oh, it's kinship. And when we acknowledge that, going, oh, he bought a new toothbrush. He didn't know he was going to die that day. Oh, my goodness.
You know,
the crucial thing of the noticing, I'm, you know, reading the news stories and I go, but then what? But then what? What then happened? Right. And you talked about the dog in the bomb when Clinton bombed Sarajevo, and you didn't, and the person interviewed didn't know what he was going to do about his injured dog. What happened to that dog? You know.
Right.
And I remember when my mom was dying and could only talk to a great mutual friend, and he said that the moment where she looked at it, where she really looked at death, is when she said, "Oh, I'm not going to know how the stories of my children turn out." And that was where it got her. You know, that was, nothing else was real until that moment. Like, oh, the story, and what has happened, the narrative. But also, travel, okay, the saddest pleasure, the greatest opportunity for stories, and how we get out the door. Maybe you can help me with this. You know, you travel a lot. I travel a medium a lot. It's part of our assignment. I was feeling guilty sometimes about jet fuel, but a great environmental activist said, "Yes, but some jet fuel is happy to carry you around, Caroline." And I go, "All right, I gotta keep that. All right, I gotta use that thing." But how we get out the door, these thresholds, because leaving,
right?
I go, "Will my animals be okay?" And you mentioned the plants and leaving the plants behind. I have a plant that hasn't bloomed in years and it's got little blooms forming. I'm going, "Oh, and I'm going to be gone, but I'll think of you."
I know. Oh, that's so haunting. Speak about poignancy. That's very haunting when you leave right on the brink of something blooming.
Right. And I'm going, "Okay, keep the temple going." But I think part of where, and I aspire to depart in a dignified fashion as opposed to like, die. I mean, the animals get more upset when I start to pace, like, "Oh my goodness, the bill's unpaid and and then when you're out, you know, once you go through that threshold, it's like you can hardly remember your name. You know, it's like,
exactly. Yeah. It's a very, very strange and quick transition from when you're so caught up with the stuff of home and the place that you're used to on a daily basis, and then suddenly you're out the door and it's like completely liberating. Thinking of your mother at that transition moment, you know, I guess that's the kind of thing we can hope for, that there will be some sensation of, "Wow, you know, okay, I won't know the stories, but I'm liberated. There's a freedom as well." I'm thinking right now about, do you think people at this time in history fear poignancy because we almost can't bear it? I mean, I think of the word poignant as being such a precious one and one that kind of guides our lives. But I think many times if people had a proper sort of dose of poignancy, could they do what they do?
I think,
is Janie ever poignant? I want to know that. If you were, could you do what you do?
No, I don't think you could.
No, it would, because you have to be hardened. You can't imagine all the stories of all the ones you're killing today, because, then it would be harder to do it.
Well, you got to be, you go, real politic. We're dedicated to larger things. This is the chess game
right.
We play. Whatever. You know, but I think, I think Americans have been narcotized most by being fed the toxic mimic of poignancy in this ridiculous celebrity culture which replaces mythology. And I don't think other culture, you know, we had Josh Rushing on the air many moons ago, and you sent me that great email going, "Josh Rushing is a hero, or our hero," you know, from Al Jazeera, right?
Yes.
You know, this guy. So, you know, he mentions that you know, when he was on The Daily Show and Jon Stewart was not so skookum, saying blah, blah, blah. But Josh Rushing was good, and he said, you know, it's possible that Iraqis might someday wish the luxury of caring about this nothing of Paris Hilton, or I don't even want to say the name, you know, but right now they don't have that luxury, and you know, it's not, they can't waste, although there is an enormous amount of soap opera in the Middle East too, so it's hard to know. I mean, it's true that wherever you go, even in the Bedouin tent, the TV is on with soap opera. So a friend of mine said that's one of the ways to go. Actually, you could use soap opera as a great, art form. So there is celebrity culture out there, I guess, in the Middle East, but I just sort of think that it's used, it never, underneath that is the conversation and the coffee and the cardamom and the ritual and the real stories. I haven't seen it actually suppress the real stories, but just be more of like, wow, this is trippy, you know, as well. And
well, do you think people channel some of their sense of poignancy through celebrity addiction and obsession? I mean, do you think because they're feeling poignant on behalf of someone else that you know, kind of keeps their sense of poignancy alive? Because they can't feel it, they can't bear to feel it for all these unnamed people. So maybe they just feel it for the celebrities they care about. I mean, I don't know.
No, I don't think so, because I don't think it's poignancy. I don't think it's like, oh, poor Michael Vick. I feel so kinned with him. It's like, no, I think people, it's schadenfreude. I think there's a weird, I view it mostly as all news and distraction, you know, going to prevent people from thinking about that which really matters, which is what, again, the texture of your book and the cleanness of your lines and your story. That's the real texture. And when, before I met you, when I'd read your poem Kindness, you know, I've been seeing the dead Indian by the road, and how does it go, that each of us has our story, each wants to find happiness, each wants to,
yeah, the levels of sadness, you know, kindness and sadness in all of us, that they're always kind of remixing and balancing, and yeah.
No, I think poignancy does want to be, it is the medicine that wants to be brewed in this country, and I have said, and I will say again, that the part of what I find intriguing about going to gather medicine in Bali is the tale. I remember reading the interview with the detective in charge of investigating the bombings, and he said, well, of course, an important investigation, first I must go to the mountains to pray, and then I will bring myself back into center, and then I can go address imbalance in the world. I'm like, oh, there we go.
Wow.
And my future collaborator there said that, you know, the Balinese response, the cultural intelligent response to the terrible bombings there, was the whole culture pulled in to say what terrible energetic, you know, imbalance has allowed this terrible thing to happen. Let us pull in and then go out. And I go, oh, that's medicine. We want that here, you know, to feel the poignancy, which happened here in this country, and then it was ripped off by war. I mean, war is the opposite of poignancy. Real politics,
that's right.
Boys, realistic, was you know, Mars with no Venus, blah, blah, blah. You know, poignancy is Venus, you know, and then the heroism of stepping in to serve Venus, to help the stranger, to, you know, my goodness, well, you know, what do you need to pick up the person in the wilderness, to drive Dora home, to... This is the thing that weaves our lives together, you know, and the empathy, and even if it's self-interested empathy, I mean, with the bug I'm saving, I go, it could be me. I would hope somebody would scoop me out of the water, you know.
That's right.
And I think we do feel poignancy for the miners all over the world buried in rubble. I think we feel poignancy for the families who don't know, you know, about their you know, beloveds in the mine in Utah. There's poignancy, you know.
Very much, yeah.
There's that, yeah. There's where we can almost begin to imagine grief, you know.
That's right. Last night I just saw on television news about how thousands of murdered Iraqi civilians were thrown into graves before their families were ever alerted or could identify their bodies or anything. So it's as if there are all these mines all over the place that, you know, bodies are trapped in and people don't know about, and that sense of sadness, you know, that so much is buried that, you know, doesn't speak to human kindness. And so what can we do? We have to keep trying to remember where we are, who else is there, how we could help, what we could help, what we could do. Now, I just keep thinking of the tidal images, you know, that there are these tides against humanity and against poignancy, and, well, and tides and stars, it's all connected.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, the awakening, the opposite of poignancy is the sociopathic brain that has been honored in this country, because this country can't really distinguish between the con man and the trickster, but the trickster liberates us from the con, who's almost always a sociopath. And so I like to say that, you know, juju etiquette says what we're really now, especially, allowed to set in motion anything of which we would be a welcoming recipient. So I like to say, you know, may it be that each human increasingly have an experience, an empathic experience of the effect of their actions on others.
Wow.
You know, yep. May it be. And I think that that's what, that it's the absence of that, the absence of the medicine in your work and in your brew and kinship and kindness, you know, that allows humans to go to war. You know, that
right.
Failure of imagination, that failure of empathy and imagination.
Oh, that's so true. The failure of imagination, the lack of empathy, yeah.
Yeah, right, so we would wish, okay, increased, you know, and it is a big one. It's like, okay, well, let's send this forth, because, okay, I'm willing to feel increasingly the effect of my actions on others, like even the cringy stuff. And see again, reading your work and your poems and your dedication to kindness, my favorite friends are really, really, really smart and kind, because the not kind part of me can go, oh, well, if somebody's not really smart, it's very, very easy for them to be kind. It doesn't really count, you know, that's my own shadow. But people who are at least as or smarter than me, who are kinder than me, I go, oh, I love that. I love them. And I think that you do that. I go, there's Naomi, you know, and yet you're, you know, the unexpected well of how can I help you? Comes through your work and quickens that in us too, which is, oh, there's that. I
a hug for your generosity.
Oh, thank you. I love my niece. When she had her baby, she said that it completely changed her experience of New York. She said the people she used to be frightened of, really like kind of tough black guys with you know, gang tattoos and stuff like that, after she had a baby, they were the people who always helped her in the subway. She said it was, you know, sort of white middle class people would flee, but it was the people she used to be frightened of who would come and go, let me help you with that, little mom. You know, do. You know, I go, the unexpected, you know, but it's true. Innocence, I can remember being, you know, victims of crime, but on occasion, knock on wood, not lately, you know, but in which innocence protected me because I treated somebody like an equal and they were up to no good. And then they just said, well, God bless you, you little person. And then I can remember also when I thought, oh, if I am innocent, if I really tell this person my circumstance, they won't harm me. And that
right.
wasn't true. You know, that was
right.
The, you know, again, the, you know, how do we be, we're all working on this, kind, savvy, innocence as strength, but also wise as serpents, you know, and I think that's, I mean, isn't that part of what you're pulling up? In your essays of things.
Well,
that
I think so. You know, and nobody's invincible. That whole thing, you know, back when we're in high school, we are immortal or invincible, and we know that we're not. As we get older, we're more and more vulnerable, and we often feel, you know, that we're carriers of so many stories of, you know, if you think about everything that happens to everybody when they go out in the world, could you step off your own threshold? Could you go across the street? Could you move out? I hope so, but I think that we're always, you know, sort of filtering through, sifting through all these possibilities that are given us, and as travelers, you know, then seeing the things that manage to change the scene for us, help us see more deeply, or help us, you know, encounter that larger moment when we're not just, you know, in our own story, but somehow privileged to experience someone else's. I guess that's what it is, you know, and often we are in the back seat or we're sidled up to someone there in a plane. We don't know who they are. We have no idea. We'll never meet again, but something's given. And that, just that transaction, that thing that happens, that exchange, is what the traveler gets to experience so frequently.
And I think also what I'll ask you three times, are you okay, your book and your work brings up, is that all the time there are these weavings, these synchronicities, you know, between all of us, and sometimes they're not known, you know. But
right.
it's the conversation which you go, oh, my goodness, oh, you were in Peshawar as well, oh, you have the same hat, oh, we both have rose gardens, we have just, oh, you know that person too. And if that conversation hadn't happened, the connections would still be there, but we wouldn't know.
That's right.
And that idea that, you know, that we are in the hands of the story guide, you know, and
that's right.
That, you know, opening up, going, oh, it's not that there's an increased rate of synchronicity, it's happening all the time, it's sort of the booking agent in charge of the choreography of the universe that we go, oh, and this, you know, but if we're open, you know, there was an interesting study on luck, academic study, but it was very simple. It was like people who described themselves as lucky and as unlucky, and what the study kind of showed is that they did a little test thing of putting money on the street, and then people were supposed to go to a cafe, and there was no open table, but there was open chairs, and so the lucky person goes down the street, picks up the money, there's nobody around, goes into the cafe, sits at the intuitively perfect table, says, I just found this, you know, generosity is important, I just found this, let me buy everybody a drink, and world-saving projects ensue. The unlucky person, you know, there was a supernatural element, people picked up the money before she got there, and she passed it by, hunkered down, pulled in, and then goes and sits by herself in the corner of the cafe. So it's simple, but they were saying luck is a kind of curiosity and generosity.
Yes. Very nice. Very, very nice. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So do you have a wish, these buses to anywhere, these being saved by strangers, these... Are we on the same map or not? Do you have a wish as we all too soon on our separate journeys that are really one journey? But do you have anything?
Well, I wish for you the most splendid, multi-textured, full of light, little bits of light shattering all around you, like in a beautiful, you know, just all the tiny, when the light comes through in all these little wonderful ways, like through an old lace curtain or something. I hope for you that beautiful kind of trip where you're just surrounded by soft encounter and amazing discovery and amazing conversation everywhere. And I wish for all of your kind listeners the same, you know, in all of our days. And every time we hear something that makes us feel separated or alone, that we can find a way to, you know, sometimes consciously make a connection with somebody else. You know, I find... in really down moments, I can almost always go out into my neighborhood. I live in the inner city, go walking somewhere, ride my bike, and find someone to connect to.
Absolutely.
That connection.
So we are connected. We are in cahoots. Naomi Shihab Nye, great book. I'll ask you three times, are you okay? And thanks very much to Ursula Nellejoy at KPFA. Bless your heart. And also Margot Kelly in Washington, D.C. I'm Caroline Casey. Next 2 weeks, we will have Catherine Austin Fitz with me on the air. I will be gathering medicine in Bali. Woof, woof, woof. Thank you so much, Naomi.
Thank you, Caroline. Thanks, Jody.
Thank you. Ooh.